Hello, and welcome to the Brad Pitt Cast Presents Four or Fewer. I'm Dan Dixon.
My name is Joseph Erb.
And today we are continuing to talk about the films of Lynn Ramsey.
We're three quarters of the way through.
You have now,
although we haven't covered You Were Never Really Here yet, you've seen that film.
I have, so I have seen the entire filmography of Lynn Ramsey.
Do you have a good time?
That's a complicated question. Broadly, yeah, I'm definitely... It's a nice thing to be a completionist on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Listen to you. Hedging very carefully.
I don't know if I had... I mean, it would be...
It would be strange to say I had so much fun.
I had a blast, yeah.
You just four films about trauma.
Yeah.
Trauma and grief.
Definitely.
That's all she makes films about. And that's what each of these films are
about.
People
being submerged in water.
Yes.
As a process of either cleansing or being traumatized.
Yes. This film...
Just with that.
This film is Lady Macbeth.
The film.
It takes one visual image, which is Tilda Swinton covered in red stuff, and just runs with it for 90 minutes.
It's never blood.
No, it starts off being tomatoes extraordinarily. Yeah. And there's a scene where she's standing in the supermarket surrounded by tomato soup, which is really extraordinary.
Mm. Which, and Lady Macbeth is never covered in blood.
No, not really.
She's dreaming. That's fine.
Is that
as an English academic.
I was going to say, is that your English PhD talking? I'm sure someone's written a PhD thesis on dreams, Jungian dreams, and Macbeth, right?
It's got to be.
Yeah.
Especially, yeah, the wood coming closer and all the...
Yeah. Have you ever seen Akira Kurosawa's Macbeth?
No.
Throne of Blood?
Oh, no. I have meant to. I think you've told me I would... I think a bunch of people have told me I should see that.
Extraordinary film. And the sequence where the wood comes to... Mm. Where is it?
Dunstanane.
Is an unbelievable. Say it again, because I maybe spoke over the top of you.
Dunsinane checks in.
Incredible.
Yeah.
That's a joke for four people. So if you're one of them, congratulations.
Yeah.
Just before we started recording, Dan was admiring one of the greatest film posters in the world, which is stuck over in the corner of my room. Is the poster for Norman J. Warren's film, Terror.
The tagline being... One Step Beyond Horror, which is positioned above the title. So you have the logic of reading is One Step Beyond Horror, ellipses, Terror. Which...
Is that how it works?
I was thinking about it. And at first, I think I was skeptical because horror seems to be the kind of apotheosis of, you know, whatever, like, bad stuff.
I guess. Horror is the worst?
But now I think, if I am... I would prefer to be horrified than terrified.
Yeah.
Because if I'm horrified, I think I can run away. And if I'm terrified, I can't. I think terror implies being frozen. You're frozen in terror. You're not... I guess you can be frozen in horror, but it doesn't... Not with the same power.
No.
Or totality. So I think terror is, in fact, one step beyond horror.
So you agree with that tagline?
I agree with the... Do you?
I do. I think I do. I'm obsessed with movie taglines at the moment. I've been going through a phase of finding my favourites. I think the all-time greatest tagline, which is, I think I've quoted on this podcast before, is the tagline for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is poetry, which is who will survive and what will be left of them.
I just had an idea for a game we could play on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
What if I look up movie taglines and see if you can guess the movie?
Incredible.
Yeah.
We used to go to a trivia night where they did just that.
Yeah.
I saw a really good tagline the other day for the Burt Lancaster vehicle, The Swimmer. Have you seen that film?
I love that film.
Yeah.
I saw it at the Art Gallery of New South Wales a few years ago.
Do you know who directed it?
I don't remember.
Katy Perry's uncle.
For real?
Frank Perry.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a spectacular piece of American cinema.
It's unbelievable. Lancaster is one of the greatest actors of all time, and he's so good in that film. If you haven't seen The Swimmer, it's about a guy, it's based on a short story by John Cheever, and it's about a guy who's at a pool party and kind of in this very affluent area and works out that he can get home by swimming in everyone's pools.
Like through seven different residences, all like very wealthy and luxurious. Yeah.
And as he goes on the journey of swimming through the pools, his life falls apart, basically. Things go real bad for him.
In a way that has some semblances in terms of its relationship with reality that Lynn Ramsey does, I think.
Yes.
That it doesn't matter if these things are real or not.
They operate at an emotional frequency, which means that they're emotionally real, even if they're not literally real. The tagline to The Swimmer is, when you talk about The Swimmer, will you also talk about yourself?
That rules.
It's so good.
And also is not an obvious... that's not the most prominent theme in the movie.
No.
But it's obviously resonant in a really interesting way.
Yeah.
Oh, that's such a beautiful film. The ending of that film. Yeah, the whole thing. It's just a real... I would give 5 stars to The Swimmer. Strong
would
recommend.
You? Yeah, really?
I love that. Because I think it does all... This may be an interesting entry point into this episode, which I feel will have me reflecting again on whether or not I like movies.
The theme of this podcast, basically.
Yeah. The Swimmer is so good at taking advantage of the twin... I think my two favourite things about cinema, which is, one, its ability to render reality in a way that no other art form can, just feel like real life, and two, its ability to ignore reality in a way that few other art forms can. Or like, I think, or it definitely in its own extremely distinct way. Like, it kind of makes the unreal real.
Mm.
I can't really speak too much about the specifics without spoiling The Swimmer, I think.
Maybe we should do an episode on The Swimmer.
Yeah, I would love to.
How many films did Frank Perry direct?
That's a great question. Ask Katie. Do you think Katie Perry's seen The Swimmer?
That's a very good question.
Do you think Orlando Bloom has seen The Swimmer?
No, Orlando Bloom hasn't seen The Swimmer. Katy Perry has maybe seen The Swimmer.
He made quite a few films.
Did he? Damn.
I'm just looking at the... Oh, wait a second.
More than four? Yeah, he directed 18.
He directed David and Lisa. The Swimmer was only his third film, though.
Oh, incredible.
I don't know many of these.
No, I don't think I do either. He made a film called Hello Again, which, talking about all-time great taglines, the tagline is, "Her life hasn't been the same since her death."
That is pretty good. He adapted Joan Didion's Play It As It Lays, which is maybe a masterpiece. It's a perfect little book, anyway.
Did he do that as a film? Where is it? I can't see it.
It's
on
from 1972. It's in... I'm looking at his Wikipedia.
Huh. Maybe it's not a film. Maybe it's a TV series.
It says movies.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. No, he did. Starring Tuesday Weld. Oh, fun. And Anthony Perkins. Oh, maybe this film is great. Quietly great. Huh. I'm gonna look out for it.
That's a great book.
We could do 18 or fewer. I was having a movie night the other night with friend of the podcast, Xavier Rubetsky Noonan. We watched Puppet Master, the first Puppet Master film. Incredible horror film.
Okay.
Actually terrible horror film.
Sure.
But a really good film to watch with a friend while you're eating a pizza.
Yeah.
From 1989. And then we watched Under Siege 2, the Steven Seagal vehicle, which is also really good. Better than Puppet Master.
Yeah.
3.5 stars. And we were talking about the career of one of the directors who's had a heavy hand in the Puppet Master franchise. His name is David Ducoteau. And he made Look, a Talking Dog. Have you heard of this film?
No.
Oh, actually, possibly Look, a Talking Cat.
A podcast that I like very much, The Flophouse, did an episode on A Talking Cat.
Because it's one of the worst films of all time. And David Ducoteau directed 142 films. So Xavier was like, well, maybe you could retitle the miniseries.
142
or fewer. And then there's no filmmaker that we can't cover.
That's pretty funny. It's a good concept.
No, the four or fewer is beautiful, as we've said before, because
I was going to think, we could flip it into 142 or more.
Yeah.
And just do directors.
And do who? I don't even know who we would do. Who's made more than 140? Who's made more than 100 films?
There must be some people in the 30s who are like churning out kind of horror or westerns or...
Yeah, a director for hire. There's certainly actors who've been in over 100
films. Yeah, John
films.
Wayne probably, right?
Yeah. Fucking what's his name? Who's in Look, a Talking Cat? Oh, Eric Roberts. We could do Eric Roberts miniseries that would take the rest of our lives if we wanted to do that. No, the beauty of Four or Fewer is that you can see there's something nice and symmetrical about it, right? I was talking about this with you in regards to Lynn Ramsey, that this is a film director who just, in the middle of her career, makes a kind of weird pivot. It's strange to think that we've gone from talking about Morven Keller to talking about We Need to Talk About Kevin. And You Were Never Really Here is a great deal like We Need to Talk About Kevin, and Morven Keller is a great deal like Ratcatcher. And Ratcatcher is kind of quite a lot like You Were Never Really Here. Mm. So it's this cycle of similarity. You're watching a filmmaker go through two very distinct phases, I think.
Yes.
That also interact with themselves in increasingly interesting ways.
When was Morven Keller made? Like 2004? Maybe
Let
later.
Let me have a look.
Because Kevin was 2011.
It had a very, very long production process.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. Ramsey was working, so we'll talk about it in a second. Morven Keller is 2002. We need to talk about Kevin is 2011. So it's her longest break. It's a 9-year break. There's a 6-year break between Kevin and You Were Never Really Here.
Okay. Almost a Malick-like break.
Yeah. So after... Don't invoke that man's name.
Sorry.
Fucking Terrence, goddamn Malick. He has to... If we talk about him too much, we're going to have to cover him in one way or another.
Well, we are, because of Brad.
Oh, goddamn.
Tree of Life's coming
when
up.
When we return to Brad, we'll be back on the fucking... on the path of Terrence Malick. Like being in the path of Godzilla. Just a slower, more boring Godzilla reading Heidegger. BBC Films acquired the rights to adapt We Need to Talk About Kevin in 2005. And Lynn Ramsey had a version of the script by 2006. And then there were just so many production problems. Basically, they couldn't raise the money to do the version of the script that she wanted.
Yeah.
So she had to do a lower budget version. Which is interesting, because this doesn't look like a lower budget film to me.
No, I wonder if... I mean, it's a film that takes a very particular... chooses to represent a very particular set of sequences from what could be a fairly rich tapestry of things to choose from, right? Like, it does have a very specific angle.
Mm.
And I wonder if that was in some way as a product of the budget. But given Ramsey's preferences, I don't feel like it. I feel like this seems like a movie she would make about... Not that I've read the book, but about a school shooting, at least.
Yeah, it's interesting because you would say maybe the one budgetary cut would be, oh, you never see the school shooting. Maybe that's...
But I think that surely isn't... Because there's no violence. There's no act of violence in the film apart from Tilda Swinton.
Yeah, she... In an interview that I just watched at the Cannes Film Festival, she makes it sound extremely deliberate that she was never going to show the school shooting. And she says, this film only contains aftermaths of violence. It actually contains no violence. Which the most extraordinary way it cuts around that is the sequence with the younger sister and the eye.
Oh, boy.
Which we'll talk about in more detail. What should we do? Should we do a 4-sentence game and then... 4-sentence game, kind of easy. Sure. Again, you could do it in a single sentence.
What's Tilda Swinton's name? What's her character's name? I don't know if she's ever... She's barely referred to by name. Eva, maybe.
You only find out, like, 3/4 of the way through if you haven't read the book that she's a well-known author.
Huh.
Right? Her son is just standing in front of a poster that says,
yes,
acclaimed travel author Eva, whatever her name is.
I think maybe I read a blurb that said she was a travel writer, but I feel like maybe you know she's a travel writer early on, but you don't know that she's
acclaimed.
Or like, yeah, Eva, definitely not.
Eva Khachaturian is her name.
Okay.
Could you do it in one sentence?
Well, I'm trying to work out whether I would do it in the order of the film, or what the order of the film even is, because it's not... It is roughly chronological in a particular... It's like... In its broad structure, let's say we see Eva. I'll just do it chronologically.
Okay. Yeah.
Eva gives birth with her husband John C. Reilly. Gives birth to a child who is as terrible a child as you can imagine giving birth to.
In every imaginable way,
and we follow their journey of parenthood through to him as a 15-year-old, wherein he. Shoots a bunch of his schoolmates with a bow and arrow after locking them into the school gym and goes to prison.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's the film.
Because she loses... I guess she gets sued. Like, that's also a thing that's very kind of lightly touched on.
It's much more touched on in the book.
Yeah.
So the book is, I think...
So she loses... Like, they because she's an acclaimed travel writer, she lives in a beautiful house with her family, her terrible family.
Who she despises.
And so the film starts... with her in a much less beautiful house by herself, being hated by everyone in her town apart from one kind boy in a wheelchair.
Yeah, who was shot victim.
By a victim of the shooting, which is a really important scene for me.
Yeah, I think it is.
There's three really, really important moments in this film for me that I have been dwelling on a lot. And that is one of them.
I mentioned it to you before we started recording, but there is an incredible review that we'll get to in a bit from a Jesuit priest, and he singles out two moments. I wonder if there's an overlap in the moments. We'll talk about it. I wanted to say a little bit about the book.
Yeah, please. I have not read it. Someone lent it to me a long time ago. I still have their copy. If you're listening, I'm so sorry. But you have my copy of Jonathan Franzen's Freedom. We swapped.
Fucking keep Freedom.
Never. I would exchange them.
I would pay someone to keep freedom away from me.
I found that a real page turner, but I read it when I was like 19.
He's always, Franzen is always a page turner.
Yeah.
He has mastered mechanistic plots in a way that means that he's always exciting to read, but he's a pain in the ass.
Sure.
When Joyce Carol Oates says autofiction books are too small and they need to be grander in scope, she's thinking of someone like Franzen, and I think Franzen reveals the problem of grandiosity and scope.
Sure.
When someone tries to write a book that sums up the era in which we live, they almost always fuck it up.
Yeah.
And it's just boring, and even more than that, kind of condescending. I think The Corrections is the only book that manages to be deeply boring and very readable at the same time.
That's interesting. Sure. I don't even know if I have thoughts on Franzen anymore. I haven't read him in like 10 years. I definitely didn't read Purity.
He did say that he considered adopting a young child from...
That was an insane thing.
Iraq?
Because he
wanted to learn about how to write about empathetic portrayals of young people.
I think... Or at least, maybe not write about, but at least understand, which is maybe more insane in some ways.
Yeah.
Not, yeah.
Fuck Jonathan Franzen. Lionel Shriver is the author of We Need to Talk About Kevin, and she is an interesting person because I think she tapped into... I was saying this just before we started recording. She tapped into the same thing that Gillian Flynn, the writer of Gone Girl, tapped into, which is that there is a market for writing highly pulpy, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I spend most of my life reading what people would call pulp. Highly pulpy, as in very readable, very narrative-focused literature about taboos. And Gone Girl is about the taboo of not knowing what your partner is thinking, or not knowing who your partner really is. It's about worrying that you have actually, this person who you've been living with for all these years is a complete cipher or an enigma to you, and there's whole parts of them that are completely inaccessible, which is this taboo we don't like talking about relationships, this idea that, oh yeah, you can really love someone, but maybe you don't have any fucking idea who they truly are. And We Need to Talk About Kevin is about the taboo of motherhood. In fact, I think it's about several taboos. I wrote down some of those taboos. Can I read you my list of taboos that I think the book and the film are about? It's just another crazy note in my phone. My phone is full of crazy notes. I have a note that just says noodles, soy sauce, rice, wine, vinegar. And I have another note that just says, my boss Dottie got the plague. So these are both shopping lists and ideas for something. I have no idea what my boss Dottie got the plague was for.
I have a crazy note from recently.
Go on.
It's illegible. Maybe you could try to read it out. It's from 4:30 a.m., which is important.
Dream World War II. From the perspective of dog. Dog chases camera out of tent and asks if the director will... Buy bands film the movie? What's buy bands?
I don't know. You know what? Thank you so much for realizing that was World War II, because I just thought it was, I don't know, WWII.
What's the last sentence?
Been very brutal up to that point.
Huh. Will buy bands film the movie?
I can't try. So I woke up at 4:30 on the 5th of May.
And thought you had an incredible idea.
Well, no, that was my dream.
Oh.
I was trying to write down my dream.
Sure.
Anyway. Sorry for the listeners for inflicting that on you. I can't work it out.
No, I can't. I can't work it out for the life of me. Go to it. Take it to a dream therapist.
Yeah, I will.
And they'll tell you that it's all about how your fear of abandonment or something like that. The taboos of We Need to Talk About Kevin. First taboo, that you will be judged for being a bad mother, which is taken to an extreme in this film, that people are stopping Eva on the street to hurl things at
her. Or hit her.
Or hit her, because they think that she's such a bad mother.
Break her eggs in the supermarket.
And force her to make an omelette when she goes home. That you will raise a child that resembles the worst part of yourself. That's a thing that the film does more than the book. I think strongly emphasize the idea that Kevin resembles Eva in all of these ways.
Yeah.
There's a sequence where she is desperately trying to connect with him and takes him mini golfing. Mm. And when they're standing there, she says something about how much she hates fat people and how she hears
Their fatness is their fault.
Yeah, there's basically all this guff from fat people that it's all, you know, being big boned or whatever, it's all lies.
Yeah.
And he says, what does he say exactly?
He says, this is one of my three moments that I think is very important, because it's, yeah. He says, you can be a bit harsh, you know. Mm. And she says, you're one to talk, or something of that to that equivalent. And he says, I know.
Yeah.
And where do you think I get it from?
Yeah. Incredible exchange. Another taboo is that you will have to deal with the ugly parts of the human body. Masturbation, poo, bad physical habits, I've written. And one of the first times we see Kevin in prison... Oh, yeah,
biting his fingernails.
He's, like, tearing his fingernails off one by one and putting them on the side of the table.
Yeah. Like, it's filmed so you never see him biting his fingernails. It's almost as if he's bitten... Like, it is as if he's biting them off one by one. But it could equally be that he's bitten them all off and is just gradually, like...
Removing them from his mouth. It's horribly visceral.
Yeah. Later mirrored in her removing the eggshells from her mouth in the omelette of the broken eggs.
There's lots of very Lynn Ramsey visual mirrors throughout this film. That your child will stop you from living your best life. That's a really important one, I think. Mm. That there's this sense in which Eva has given something away by having a child that she deeply regrets and misses.
And also your desire to live your best life in spite of the child will then reflect, like, the child will know that they are in fact a burden, and that will make them worse.
Yeah, which it absolutely does. That your child will ruin your marriage is another taboo, which happens.
And yes.
Just extremely viscerally.
Yeah.
Because John C. Reilly is the worst.
I've been thinking about him as a casting decision. I think I've come down on it being good.
I think it's an extraordinary casting decision. Did you waver? You didn't think it was so good?
I think because the whole time I was like, that's John C. Reilly.
Yeah, it's like impossible Chaffee. Not to see him. Like Chaffee.
You know the tweet.
Yeah, I know the tweet. My last taboo is that your children will hate one another, which, like, everything in...
Yeah, although the daughter doesn't really hate Kevin.
No.
Which might be worse.
Yeah, but Kevin has some issues with...
Yeah, let's say your children won't get on.
Yes. So basically, I think the success of the book, which was a phenomenally successful book, which is kind of weird,
which is fascinating,
because it's very dark. Shriver had never written anything that popular before, and it suddenly became an extremely popular bestseller.
I think there's two things to that. One is that I think people love a book that seems to offer an answer to something, which is interesting because I don't know because the film more or less doesn't.
It, in fact, rejects the opportunity to provide an answer.
Which I think is related to one of the things about this film I found challenging. I thought this was it was a very Lynn Ramsey film. It was a well-made film, and there's a lot to admire in it, but I'm not sure how I feel about it.
Yeah. Many people contacted me in anticipation of this episode, wondering what you would think about this film. Because it's got to be a cruel film.
It's, you know what's really funny, is So I watched the first half of this with Alana, my partner, last night, and the second half this morning, because it was kind of late, and I just couldn't quite deal with it, to be frank. Last night, I was planning to watch the whole thing last night, but just found it a bit overwhelming.
At what point did you divide it into?
I remember the shot, like, it's on SBS streaming, so it was during an ad break. Like 45 minutes in.
Okay.
Maybe more, actually. No, maybe like... Yeah, around 45 minutes in. Maybe a little further in. I can't actually remember the exact point. Partially because it's so fragmented. And you had said to me... We had a brief phone conversation this morning, and you said to me you thought it was cruel. And I said to her, like, I'm not sure if cruel's the word. And she's like, you literally used that word last night.
What did you say?
I said... I don't know, but I described the film... I described myself as worrying the film was cruel, apparently. Mm. Maybe during the non-stop crying.
Yeah.
Or the ball scene. She wants him to throw the ball back to her. Which is not... Yeah. My reflection on it after... And that was after I finished it when I had the call with you. I kind of woke up this morning and just finished it.
Good movie to put a pep in your step early in the morning.
I think it's more... My biggest... The biggest challenge for me with this film, which is an extraordinary rendering of trauma, and I think it wants to be a movie in some ways about evil, and I think I don't think evil is a thing that exists in the world, basically. And I also don't know if I'm very interested in finding out about evil, because evil doesn't seem very interesting to me. The thing that astonishes me about the world is not that there are evil people who do evil things I mean, there's a bunch of stuff around this that makes me feel very unfinished with this film. There's a bunch of stuff I can, like, say in response to myself. But the thing that astonishes me about the world, as I say, is not that evil people do evil things. It is that, relentlessly, it seems like people have motivations for their actions. Like, it seems like actions are often more or less explicable and occurring within a context. One of the things I like the least, and I think this film very deliberately and intelligently doesn't fall into this trap, although still flirts with it, is this idea of the kind of psychopath or sociopath. Mm. I hate that archetype, because every now and then, like, you know, there'll be a news article, is this person a sociopath? We use those archetypes to explain away the complexities of the world and the complexities of people.
Mm.
And how people justify things to themselves, and how much people want to be perceived as good people often. And this is a film that very deliberately avoids questions of therapy. There is one scene in which Eva takes Kevin as like a 5-year-old to a GP, maybe a 4-year-old, 3-year-old, because he's not talking. And the GP's like, there's nothing wrong with him. So it basically sets up the medical establishment as failing, but then doesn't really talk about it again. Doesn't label Kevin a sociopath, psychopath. But what it does do is it has that, and one of the reasons I think that scene at the golf course where you see Eva's dark side reflected in Kevin is really important is because that seems to suggest that she bears some responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Or it either suggests she bears some responsibility or sets the character up to be interrogating herself as to whether she bears some responsibility. But at the same time, it also sets John C. Reilly's character up as the father to be extremely neglectful, very naive, and a terrible father and husband. But Kevin is awful from the moment he is born. There is this kind of a priori evil that seems to exist within him. And the novel doesn't really, or the book, the movie rather, doesn't really suggest that there could have been a different set of things that could have been done to avoid this. It also, fascinatingly, especially, and this speaks to when the book was written and when the movie was made, doesn't really speak to questions of politics.
No.
Which it shouldn't have to. Like, I don't want, this doesn't need to be a message film. But what it fascinatingly does is there is the third scene, if I'm not monologuing for too long, the third scene that I find fascinating in this movie is when Kevin's bike locks arrive, which it turns out he uses to lock people in the gym so he can shoot them with his bow and arrow. Eva says, why are you buying these? They're, you don't use your bike anymore. And John C. Reilly said, and then the answer Kevin gives is like, I got them really cheap online, I'm going to sell them at school. And John C. Reilly says, oh, like, you're like Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Which, insanely, for a 2011 film, presages a bunch of, like, if you watch this film in 50 years, you would think what it is doing is like making a subtle hint about the alt-right, incels,
conservatives. The sociopaths.
But it's not, I mean, maybe in some capacity, but not in the capacity we would imagine it to today. And that is really, it's just an interesting thing.
Yeah. It's a film that dodges it, as you say, it's not a film about the school shooter experience. It's not Gus Van Sant's Elephant.
Which I quite like.
I like Elephant.
I haven't seen it in a long time.
But I know a lot of people who hate it, but I think it does a very novel thing, which is just be like tricking the audience into slowing into a meditative pace and then breaking that pace in order to simulate what it's like to be woken up by the violence of the world. It's a very simple trick, and the film does nothing but that trick, but that's totally fine with me. It works perfectly mechanistically and well. No, this is not a film about a school shooter. This is a film about a relationship between a mother and a child, and more than that, I think it's a film about a mother's responsibility to the pain and suffering that she thinks she's caused. What you say is interesting about, you know, there's no indication that Kevin could have been any other way than an evil child. I was just watching an interview with Lynn Ramsey and Tilda Swinton conducted at Cannes, where Swinton tells the anecdote that she and Lynn Ramsey were thinking about alternate titles for the film, and one of them that they considered was Performance, which is the name of the Nick Rogue, Mick Jagger, incredible 70s thriller.
Mm.
And the reason why Swinton wanted to call it Performance was because she felt that this was a film about authenticity, and she thought that the film is an indictment on the family around Kevin, and strangely positive on Kevin, because she thinks that it's a film about a family who cannot authentically connect with Kevin and are full of these... Swinton in the interview says that everyone around Kevin is reading off of cue cards. The dad is completely false and completely fake. He doesn't connect with his son at all. John C. Reilly's character, I think, is predominantly egotistical.
Definitely.
He loves Kevin because of the ways that Kevin kind of flatters him. Yeah. And he's not really connecting with Kevin at all. And I think that's why that scene in the golf, the mini golf course is so important, is because Kevin realizes that this is the first time that his mother is authentically connecting with him, because she's being her true self. She's being ugly in the way that he knows he is and he thinks that she is too. And she's dismissing this error of performance and doing something real.
And she is very taken aback when he calls her out on it. She doesn't know how to engage in that on that level. That is really interesting. I buy that more or less. I think... I wonder if the film is consistent enough in its conveying of that point. And I don't need to be hammered over the head with it. But I did have this sense of contradiction. I mean, the other very important thing that could be a key to this problem for me is the final line of the film, where she asks... She's, for the first time, you see kind of Kevin scared. He's about to turn 18, so he's about to go to a men's prison. And he's expressing some fear about that, and Eva is visiting him, and she says, you know, you've had 2 years to reflect on it. Why did you do it? And he says, I used to think I knew, but now I'm not so sure, or something like that.
Yeah.
And that is important. That kind of opens him up in a way where he might not be purely...
just evil.
Just evil.
I wanted to... I was going to hold off on this later, but I think it's come up too much. We have to do it now.
Okay.
There is a review, an extraordinary review.
Is it contemporaneous? Was it when the film was...
Yeah. It was released in 2012 in January.
Oh, yeah.
So just after the release of the film. This is from a website called Busted Halo. And the byline for this website is Faith Shared Joyfully.
Wonderful.
So it's a Christian website. This is a review of We Need to Talk About Kevin, written by Friar Jake Martin. And it's one of the most...
A real friar.
It's one of the most... No, actually, FR means father.
Oh, yeah. What a shame.
Damn. Are there still friars?
Hope so.
I hope so.
Which is interesting, because Friar Tuck from Robin Hood, central trope in We Need to Talk About Kevin.
So I've accidentally stayed relevant.
What would your therapist have to say about that?
Yeah, very good question. Jake Martin has written one of the most astounding pieces of film criticism I've ever read. I'd like to read you a couple of sections from the brief sections.
I literally have no idea. I know that this film, this review exists. I know as much as you do, dear listener, so I'm excited to go on the journey.
Just, I'm shaking my head in disbelief. At first glance, it would seem that Kevin is yet another installment in the pantheon of postmodern films intent upon assaulting the human desire to give meaning to the world. Indeed, Kevin is a relentless film that gives its audience few opportunities to come up for air from the depths of anguish to which it plummets.
Mm.
So when I first started reading this review, I thought, oh, of course, this is a Christian website that is going to take umbrage with the fact that We Need to Talk About Kevin is a deeply nihilistic work of art. Yet it is in those infrequent instances of relief, conversion, and mercy that the film finds its identity and direction. Kevin is a story of hope for a new millennium.
Whoa.
And It's a Wonderful Life in the age of school shootings and planes crashing into buildings. A world-weary world that has been bombarded by nihilistic themes in their narratives for the better part of the century. It is a world where any attempts to offer a message of mercy, conversion, and redemption must be done deftly and authentically, because at the end of the day, sometimes the community won't rally around you. So that's where he lays out what he's going to say. The most significant and poignant moment is found at the end of the film, when the 18-year-old Kevin, 2 years into a prison sentence for a heinous incident at his high school, responds to his mother's query as to why he did what he did. He answers, "I used to think I knew why, and now I'm not so sure." This small act of hesitant humility is followed by Kevin's embrace of his mother, which can only be likened to the embrace received by that infamous scriptural progeny upon his arrival home.
The prodigal son.
The prodigal son.
Because he doesn't hug her, she only hugs him.
He hesitates, though,
yeah,
in a way that seems
to invite... He accepts the embrace.
Yeah, exactly. The first time you've seen them really, truly embrace.
Yeah. Have we said also that he kills the father and the sister?
No, we haven't said that yet. But
which I think plays into that scene as well. Like, it's not... I mean, obviously,
It's a shocking moment. Yes. It's one of the most shocking moments in the film. So this review, Jake Martin, his basic thesis is that he agrees with what Tilda Swinton is saying about performance, and he thinks that this is a film about the need to authentically and with humility connect with other people. And he thinks that Eva's problem throughout the film is that she refuses to connect properly with her son. And he points to the sequence in which, after they go mini-golfing, when they've had this genuine moment of connection, Kevin sits there and he's like, well, what do you want to talk about? You want to ask me how school is going? You want to say this, that? When you've had a couple of glasses of wine, you want to ask me about sex? He's like parroting this cliche dialogue that is expected. So the review is this idea that we need to actually connect with people, and we do so via grace. And if I can just read the very last sentence of this review. Ultimately, what we need to talk about Kevin winds up giving us is perhaps the most important truth of Christianity, namely that God is the hope to be found in the midst of the smoke and ashes.
I mean, that's extraordinary. And it's interesting because it's in relation to Christian themes, let's say. One line that sticks with me from Marilyn Robinson's Gilead, which is a profoundly Christian novel, is when the reverend who is narrating that talks about being able to see the face of Christ in everyone, like that as a kind of a challenge of faith. And it's interesting because I think I think that line occurred to me while I was watching We Need to Talk About Kevin, because it feels like this film... I think you could look at this film one way and think that it does have trouble humanizing Kevin.
It does what?
Have trouble humanizing Kevin.
Hmm.
But maybe the father makes a good point. I don't know.
You think that Kevin is just the evilest child in imaginable.
I don't... There's kind of the two options, right? Like, are we... And I know it's not this simple. I didn't dislike this film at all. It really is just a film where I feel like I haven't been able to make up my mind about it, or haven't kind of come to conclusions about it. But there's the... Are we then saying that it is the parents' fault?
She definitely thinks it's her fault, right? The film is very much about self-punishment.
Well, the other fascinating thing is that when she is being kind of hounded by the townsfolk...
Quite literally.
Yeah. There's an extraordinary scene during Halloween where... Which, feel again, in Ellen Ramsey mode, feels like maybe it's real, maybe it's not, but that's just not the right question to ask.
Mm.
Where... kids come to her house for trick-or-treat. She realizes she doesn't have anything in any of the cupboards to give them. And then, like, they start banging the door and rattling the windows and throwing things at the house when she refuses to open the door because she's home.
It's a zombie movie
sequence. Yeah. She broadly, when all these terrible things are happening to her, like, she's never... When she is hit in the street by a woman, she's given opportunities to take revenge or lash out, and she never does. She always accepts the punishment. Yeah. She's just like, thanks, I'm leaving, I'm not gonna,
I think she thinks that this is her cross to bear, and I think the reason why she thinks that is not just that she's causally responsible to Kevin, that she's literally the person who birthed him, which is what her critics seem to think the problem is. They call her a monster just because she gave birth to Kevin. Yeah. She understands that there's something deeper going on, and that actually Kevin is a reflection of her. Mm. Kevin is a reflection of her cruelty and her meanness and the way that she struggles with authenticity. In this interview that Ramsey and Swinton gave, they say that one of Kevin's biggest problems is that he struggles to find purpose. So they're talking about it as a very sympathetic portrayal of someone who, they call him highly intelligent, but say that he just doesn't know what to do with his life, so he applies his intelligence to something horrendous.
Yeah.
I think that issues of whether or not Eva is responsible for Kevin turn on a scene that you could read in two ways, which we've kind of mentioned a couple of times already.
Yeah.
In which Kevin is sick, he's unwell, and Kevin has, growing up, hated his mother, spurned his mother. He seems actively spiteful towards his mother and seemingly loves his father. Although I think, as Swinton and Ramsey say, the film is intelligent about the fact that what's actually going on is Kevin is performing a kind of love for his father. Definitely. That is completely fake, completely artificial. Yeah. I mean, it's telling that he decides to kill his father and his sister and not his mother. He lets her survive. Really interesting to wonder whether he's doing that as a form of punishing her or if he recognizes a deep kinship. So there's this sequence in which, after you've seen a lot of Kevin being horrendous to his mother, he's sick, and then he kind of sidles up to his mother and invites her to read him a story, and his father comes in to talk, and Kevin says, like, fuck off, basically, to his dad. It's the first time he's ever spoken harsh words to his father on screen. And the book that Eva is reading Kevin in a very sick joke is the story of Robin Hood.
And then he gets a, like, play bow and arrow.
And graduates then to the real thing, and then graduates to using the bow and arrow to commit a school shooting.
Which is also a really interesting choice of... I assume that's in the book?
It is, yeah.
It is just really... I mean, it makes it... Shriver is British, and so is Ramsay. And there is something about the, like... This is not...
Ramsay is Scottish.
Scottish, sorry.
I just...
Yeah.
We'll get in trouble.
Apologies to our Scottish listeners. There's something about... Like, this is not a movie that is interested in guns.
No.
In the school shooting department. At all.
That's one of the ways where it skirts discussions about school shootings, I think, intelligently. That it's not a book. It's not a book nor a movie about gun control. It's not any of those questions.
Which I think is... It benefits it, obviously.
It would be a worse film if this was an attempt to unpack the mind of the school shooter. It's not. Kevin is a awful human being first, and a school shooter second in a really important way. I'm not generalizing that and saying that's the case in the real world. I'm just saying in the world of this film. So this scene in which Eva reads Kevin the book, and the fact that it is the cause of the school shooting, and there's a direct causal link between her reading this book. It's really...
And it's kind of the one moment where he prefers her over his father, superficially, outwardly.
It's interesting to ask, does he commit the school shootings with a bow and arrow in order to make his mother feel responsible? Mm. Is it a very long, sick joke in order to say, like, you did this to me? Or does he have a moment of genuine connection with his mother, and the only thing that he can do with that genuine connection is manifest it as an act of violence? And the film throws up its hand and doesn't answer that question. But it is interesting for a film that is so much about performativity versus authenticity to think, what is authentic about what Kevin is doing? What is authentic about Kevin at the end of the film? You know, what moments are real?
I was having dinner with some friends the other night, and... mentioned this film, and that I was doing it for the podcast, and one of them, who was doing a PhD in criminology, mentioned a friend of hers who is doing a PhD on children abusing parents, basically, whatever that, and apparently I don't know this person, but they gave a presentation on this and used We Need to Talk About Kevin as a framing device. And one thing that this friend who was relating this story mentioned is that it is almost always boys against mothers, always gendered. And that's another thing I was really curious about in this film, because while it doesn't make a great deal of the gendered nature of Kevin and Eva, it does portray John C. Reilly as in a way that is quite gendered, the kind of neglectful, self-centered father.
Yeah, who thinks it's also easy.
Yeah, and because it's his boy, you know, he's just being a boy. There might actually be a line somewhere in it that I think might be off screen, but you hear John C. Reilly saying something like, this is what, you know, young boys do. There's a scene in the hospital after Kevin has been, I don't know if it's entirely clear how, but basically been responsible for his little sister losing an eye to drain cleaner. Eva says, it was Kevin. And John C. Reilly is like, you got to talk to someone. He is convinced that his wife is blaming Kevin for things that he is blameless for. Consistently, that's kind of a repeated theme. And so there is this kind of interesting gender dynamic that is never... And I sometimes wondered whether the film made too little of it and just didn't want to have to deal with it. Again, I don't want this to be a message film, but I also don't want it to kind of act as if these things are contextless. I don't know. But I think more or less it handled that. If it did handle it, it handled it through Reilly, and that is interesting.
It's why Lynn Ramsey is an interesting choice for this film, right? And we've talked...
Fascinating choice.
It's so strange.
I don't know if I clarify this when you said, but it didn't surprise me at all when you said that the people were not happy with the film Ramsay wanted to make of this book, because you have a very popular book, and there's so many, I mean, again, I have not read it, but can very very much imagine the very palatable films that could be made of this book, and the very popular films that could be made of this book, and this is not, Lynn Ramsay is not the person to do that.
No.
She might be the person to make this movie,
Yeah. Well, because the interesting thing about Ramsay that we've discussed over the course of two episodes now is that Ramsay is first and foremost an imagistic filmmaker.
Yeah, absolutely.
She is interested in images. She, in this interview that I keep talking about that she did at the Cannes Film Festival, she explicitly says, I'm not a novelist. I don't write books. I write films. And she is first and foremost a filmmaker. I think there are a lot of filmmakers who basically write...
They're rendering prose.
Yeah, and that's not what she's doing.
Which is good. Like, but there were times when I wondered if the imagistic focus of this film was right for the material in the way that it was imagistic.
Yes, that's kind of what I'm poking towards. That what makes her such a strange choice for this film is that this is a film that does, whether you like it or not, have to have something to say about gender, about violence. And Ramsay completely ducks every opportunity to talk about those things and instead focuses on images and in particular an image. I wonder how much of this running time is Tilda Swinton submerged in something red.
Yeah.
It's the predominant focus of the film is this idea of like a guilt or a trauma. And it's not... The interesting thing about Lynn Ramsay, I think, throughout her career, and we'll see it even more next time in You Were Never Really Here, because that... You Were Never Really Here has echoes of Kevin in the sense that, as some critics pointed out, You Were Never Really Here is a Pizzagate film. It's a film about the central conspiracy of Pizzagate. It's about the idea that
Jeffrey Epstein, like...
Yeah, there's a pedophile ring happening in the upper echelons of DC politics. And similarly, it's about those things while not at all wanting to have anything to say about those things.
I think I so don't... I detest the idea that we expect to be have our films agree with our politics or tell us what to think. There's nothing that makes art more boring than the obligation, than that feeling obligatory. Some art can do that well, but it absolutely shouldn't have to, because that's just not art. That's not what it does. Like, that's not one of the things it needs to do. But there is... I think there are ways in which this film approaches those questions and then skirts them, as you say, which just left me feeling a little, like, confused. And I wonder whether... Something I was talking about with Alana as well after watching the first half of this film, and maybe this changes in the second half, particularly with the ending, this kind of fear and this fear of it kind of being exploitative. As if it's showing this horrifying thing, which it's very interesting that it doesn't dell on the violence, because that, I think, pulls it back from the brink somewhat. But that it's using the figure of the school shooter for particular drama and the images we're all, like, it's drawing on these images we're very familiar with of the cops around the school and the sirens and this sense of shock and trauma that is referring to something from real life. And once you are in conversation with that thing, there are certain elements of the conversation that you need to at least acknowledge. And it feels like sometimes it's on unsteady ground there. But I don't know. Maybe, again, I'm not settled on these questions.
You know who called it exploitative?
Who? Roger Ebert?
No, Richard Brody.
Interesting.
Brody thought that it exploited the child, demon child trope, but has nothing interesting to say about it. And I think that just shows that Brody wants something different from cinema to me, because I don't need a film to tell me anything. I don't need to speak in a comprehensible voice whatsoever. I think I'm someone who wants to be bowled over by images. So I don't really have these concerns, the concerns that you're talking about, just because I am just there to see some incredible images. Yeah. And the sequence, I think we've got to talk about it, the sequence in which the school shooting is actually committed is extraordinarily directed.
And also cut kind of maybe throughout the entire film, but certainly throughout a lot of the film.
There's just a moment where you kind of see it happen for a slightly extended period of time in which Kevin is bowing on stage. And it's a moment the kind of which we've seen from Ramsay a couple of times before, where reality breaks and suddenly we're in a completely different world. Kevin is standing in an empty gym and there's screaming going on. So there's this complete disconnect between image and sound.
Yeah.
And it's the moment with the rat going to the moon in Ratcatcher. Yeah. It's the moment of Morven Keller showing her lingerie to the fisherman in Morven Keller. It's this moment where reality is suspended and we're somewhere else entirely.
Well, there's another one of those moments that I should have mentioned earlier that Again, I could be convinced on this, but there's one interpretation of this sequence that I really don't like, which is when Kevin is on the television and Tilda Swinton is watching it in her home. An adult Kevin, or like a 15, 16-year-old Kevin or whatever. The older Kevin. And he is saying something like, you know, you go to... like, the kind of lame teenage screed against society. You go to your little jobs, you like, then you get home and you watch people on TV and they're watching television and now you're watching me, and if I'd been like a good boy and gotten A's in geography, you wouldn't be watching me, so what are you doing? And it reminded me of some of the conversation around The Last of Us 2, which is the film, the game where I played the first one but haven't played the second one, but purportedly it like makes you do all these horrifying things
and then tells you off,
yeah, and then like gets mad at you for doing them. And it felt, and I can't quite work out that scene, because it even though this film doesn't actually show that much violence, it is not a like, you know, boring violent or like a like the classic trope of like violent cinema or upsetting cinema that people go to whatever, like it felt like, is Kevin telling me off watching this movie?
I don't think so.
Then what is the point of that scene?
Because I think it's another case of Kevin struggling to find authenticity and being unable to do anything, yeah, but parrot things that he's heard. That's what you're saying, right? That is, this is, yeah, a very tired, worn out trope.
Exactly.
And Kevin, because at a very young age he finds that he's surrounded by fakeness, he just emulates all different kinds of fakeness. The only, yeah, person he's really real with is his mother.
Yes.
And he performs for his dad, he performs for school, he performs in all of these ways, and that too I think is just a performance. And I think that's undercut by the line when he's asked, when she, Eva asks him, why did you do it? He can't really answer, and it's just, he's just parroted something that he's seen on TV because he doesn't know how to speak authentically.
Well, it's really interesting that they show Kevin consuming very little stuff, right? Mm. There's a sequence where she searches his room, Eva searches his room when he's at school or whatever, and finds a CD written with "I love you" written on it. She puts it into her computer and it infects it with a virus. And there's like no other hints that he's like, she's obviously looking for some, like she looks through all these notebooks and nothing's written in them, which suggests that there's no depth as well, right? And this is a film about kind of depth and surface, I think, and it's especially interested in surface. But there's one scene in which child Kevin is playing video games and is just being like, die, die, which you do see kids doing sometimes. Like, it feels really on the nose.
Mm.
Another fascinating thing about this film is no one goes into this film not knowing it's about a school shooting, but it would be so interesting seeing this film and not knowing that, because at what point would you work it out?
Yeah.
Probably pretty early, but it would be interesting not knowing it from the beginning.
Yeah, it's in a way a shame that everyone going into this film will know that that's what happens.
Because it's really, for one, it's only kind of partially about that, and two, the film, like, a bunch of foreshadowing stuff becomes less interesting because we already know. So he's playing that video game with his dad. He is Red Robin Hood and he likes archery. So he kind of increases they've got a big backyard. He has a target. He upgrades from like little suction arrows to real arrows, then uses them to kill a bunch of people. Also, I think a quality of the film is it doesn't tell you how many people he killed, how many people he injured, his relationships with anyone at school, what teachers think of him, punishments at school. It doesn't go into any of that stuff, which is one of Lynn Ramsey's greatest talents, I think, is knowing what to just not pay attention to.
Yeah.
But we just don't seem engaging with the world at all. The masturbation scene is horrifying as well, and really interesting.
Truly one of the most horrifying sequences in the film.
Yeah.
But I don't think we need to see him engage in the film. I think because this is a film about tropes and the performance of tropes, he is all surface. And in fact, in the final sequence, his mother asks him to go beyond the surface, he's literally unable to do that. All he's doing is taking on these, and that's why the archery is such an interesting thing. Is it the one thing in his life that he's really connected with, or is this two just surface level attempts to get back at his mother? And I think that's mirrored in the film textually, in that you said the sequence of him playing with the video game is on the nose. I think there's a lot of on-the-nose stuff in this film, because it's a film about... when we say something is on the nose, what we're saying is it's too much surface, right? Yeah. And this is a film about a character who is too much surface. I think one of the most on-the-nose moments is... when I watched this film with Xavier Rubetsky-Noonan.
Mm.
Shout out to Xavier. And he was laughing, and I think you are meant to laugh. In the scene after... Kevin's sister has come back from the hospital after losing her eye. Kevin is comically, I think genuinely comically,
eating a lychee.
I
find that horrifying.
Really? I think
it's... Because the lychee's supposed to resemble the eye.
I think it's funny. I think it's designed to be funny in this awful, darkly comedic way. It is a kind of very on the nose. And Xavier was laughing and being like, don't leave fruits that can comically echo something that's just happened just lying around.
Yeah.
After you bring your daughter home from the hospital for losing her eye, just take all the lychees out of the fruit bowl. Do something.
Well, yeah. The acquired taste, he says. When his mother says, I thought you didn't like those. There's a lot of that in the film. But that's, again, the film's visual thematic. Thematizing, right, over substantive. Not, I don't mean to say the visual isn't substantive. Over, like, narrative, say, or like it's interested in the fact that he's eating a lychee and that looks like an eye. It's not that interested in what that does in the story.
No.
I think I just wonder about the like slight disconnects between what it's trying to do with like thinking about the lack of depth, thinking about what lack of depth means, what taking on various surfaces means, what performance means. And connecting those with a thesis. Which again, we've established as one of the differences between you and me in cinema, is that I think I do look for these kind of coherent theses. That I want something being said. It doesn't have to be like a political message, but just some kind of... something said about the world.
Mm.
And what it is to experience the world. And I just found that... my desire for that kept being kind of coming up short in this film. And maybe that's the intention. It doesn't... I mean, not maybe that... Maybe it's coherent in that way. I don't know.
It's interesting to think you were praising Lynn Ramsey for not making a film about anything in the case of Morven Keller and Ratcatcher.
Yeah.
So why do you think you feel differently about this film? Because it brushes up against these things?
I think I was thinking about that specifically, actually. And I think before the podcast. And I think one of the things is they are about a world I'm unfamiliar with.
Hmm.
They're about, like, Morven Keller and Ratcatcher are films about... I don't want to use this word pejoratively, although it sounds kind of pejorative, and I don't think Ramsey is doing this because it's about her world in some ways. But in some ways, it's like going to the zoo. You're like seeing these, or like watching a documentary. You're like seeing an alien world. Like, I'm not familiar with Scotland. I'm not familiar with the eras they represent. I'm not familiar with the kind of cultures they represent. Whereas Kevin is not only a culture that I've seen represented many times, I'm also like, I have been a young white male teen. And I think there's something about the nothingness of Morven Keller and Ratcatcher, or their kind of surface focus, or strangeness, or like estrangement, let's say, that feels like I'm being shown something I'm unfamiliar with. And I feel like I'm familiar with a lot of the stuff I'm being, like, as I was saying, like, so much of the tropes around school shootings it draws on, and this is where it might come down to me as a viewer rather than the film as a film. So many of the tropes it draws on are things that are in popular culture. It's not just that I'm a white man and have been a white teen. It's that and maybe this changes in 2021, right? It's so a film of its era in some ways.
It's so a film of its era.
We have seen, and also like fascinating for a film that starts production pre-financial crisis and finishes production post-financial crisis. I think that's important too. Like, disaffection has different kind of meanings in the 2000s and the 2010s and alienation. But It's that these things are so present. Like, the alienness of it feels strange or, like, insufficient or something.
Because it's something that's familiar to you. Yeah. I should say this isn't my favourite Lynn Ramsey film. I've said before that Morven Keller is my favourite one. Maybe we'll do a proper ranking next week, but I think it's...
Yeah. I think it's a well-made, affecting film with extraordinary performances.
I think it's her least successful film.
Yeah.
And I've only said positive things about the film, and I think it's a very good film. I really like it. Yeah. I think, as you say, the performances are unbelievable. Tilda Swinton could just perform anything, and she performs it so extraordinarily here. She, again, in this interview that I will now bring up for the final time at this Cannes interview, she says that she thought that films have gone downhill since people started talking. That she hates dialogue in films.
Very funny.
And that she was very drawn to the idea of making this film because she could make everything interior. And indeed, it is a film about interiority. she plays everything on her face. There's a sequence...
Oh, yeah.
Which I thought was maybe one of the sequences that would make you think this is a cruel film, because the film kind of just shows it to you and wallows in it. She takes a job at a real estate agency.
Yeah.
Not a travel agency, sorry. Travel agency. And there is a... Everyone is kind of indifferent towards her except for this one man who works there. Yeah. A lech who seems to be interested in her, and then at one point he invites her to dance at a Christmas party and she turns him down, and he comes very close to her and basically whispers, "Who the fuck do you think you are? Nobody's ever gonna want you. Like, this was your one chance to have some kind of human intimacy." And then he pulls away and she leaves the party.
Yeah.
And her face after he's seen that, after he said that, that like wound, that very deep wound that you see get inflicted onto her, and then immediately afterwards a face of acceptance of the wound. So much of this film is about awful things happening to Tilda Swinton and her ultimately accepting them, because I think rightly or wrongly, she believes that she is responsible for what happens. She thinks this is her penance.
It's interesting that you bring up that travel agency with regards to cruelty in this film, because I do think that's the cruelest aspect of the film. And I don't think Lynn Ramsey is necessarily doing this, but obviously she's been a renowned travel writer and now she's working at this shitty travel agency. There was this, like, it's a pretty horrible office to work in. I know there are horrible offices to work in. I know there are many people in the world who are cruel to other people. But I sometimes feel, in the similar way that I sometimes feel about the Coen brothers, there is a sense of antipathy from the director towards everyone working in this office. And I know that offices are like... There's often very little nice about offices. But it feels like, to me, and I guess I hesitate to say this because I don't commit to this position entirely, but it makes me suspicious of it, even if I don't think it's what Lynn Ramsey is doing. I'm this creative person and look at all these stupid people working in this office. It's such a grey and dark fate that is being represented here that I just want more light. And there is that, which is why I really appreciate the scene where the kid in the wheelchair who is injured because he has been, and says maybe he'll walk again because he was shot by Kevin, comes up to her and asks her how she is. And is perfectly nice to her. The only person in the film who is perfectly nice to her. There is that sense that not everyone is awful. Not everyone has lost their mind. Not everyone is ground down. But it just... I wanted just a bit more of that in different contexts.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's that is also something in the world. You know, there is lightness in the world.
I think The Office is just part of the trial. I think
there
is this notion that she is constantly on trial, and the office is just one of the things that she has to face up to.
Sure.
One of the ways that she has to try and reintegrate into the world while carrying this cross on her shoulders. It's also a film with a lot of Christian imagery and a lot of Christian ideas of suffering, which means perhaps it's unsurprising that the father responded to it in this way.
It's also, it reminded me of a George Saunders short story.
Yes, absolutely.
Like, it felt that, particularly the travel agency, a woman who is a travel writer, son commits a school shooting, has to work in a travel agency, could just be a George Saunders short story. Yeah,
absolutely. And it does. But see, this is the thing about Saunders, which I know you don't always love Saunders on this level, but I think Saunders puts his characters through awful things to show the value of goodness.
Yeah.
It's almost like a retrospective look at goodness. You find out what goodness is by submerging yourself in its exact opposite.
Yeah.
And I think Ramsey kind of does something similar.
Throughout her films.
She definitely does in You Were Never Really Here. That's kind of the purpose of You Were Never Really Here.
Driving through hell.
Yeah, exactly. And finding some goodness along the way. It's going to be a lot of fun to talk about You Were Never Really
Here. I can't wait to see it again.
When did you last see it? At Sydney Film Festival?
Which I think would have been in 2016 or 2017.
Yeah. A long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, time fucking flies.
Mm.
Do you have any other final words before we do the Letterboxd game?
I worry that just sometimes because of the way our dynamic works out, I came out as more of a critic of this film than I actually am.
You seem to genuinely engage with it in a way that doesn't mean that you hate it.
Yeah, definitely. I recently heard someone point out that ambivalent does not mean you don't care. It means you're swinging between positive and negative feelings, which I hadn't used that word that way traditionally. But I like that. I think that's a useful term. Like, ambivalent, right? Like, I'm in some ways ambivalent about this film. in that I care about it, but do not know how to kind of where to... I don't always know where to put my feelings about it. I still am very... Lynn Ramsey is one... I can say, having seen all her films, one of the more fascinating directors working today.
I really
appreciate that she's doing her thing. I will say that.
She really is. We talked about it before we even started this miniseries, but Tilda Swinton once said of Lynn Ramsey, if she's one of the rare filmmakers of whom you would say, if she wasn't making these films, no one else would be. And it's true.
Especially in this current era. There's so little of that.
Yeah, there's no filmmakers really working who have the same set of preoccupations as she does.
And so filmic as well, which is such a relief, you know. You watch so many films that just could be anything and don't take advantage of their filmness.
Yeah, and these are first and foremost films above everything else. Letterboxd game?
Yes, please.
3.6,
I'll say.
Do you want a second guess?
3.9?
Yes.
Yeah.
I knew you'd get it. How did I know you'd get it?
I don't know. I think that's the second time in a row we've done that.
Yeah, that you've got it on the second try. Well done.
Thank you.
You really thought about it.
I did really think about it.
I'm gonna leave the pause in when I was asking for your second guess.
I was looking around the room.
You were really drawing something from the world around you.
I was feeling the air.
So let's do a review from... let's just quickly read a review from Xavier Rubetsky Noonan.
Oh, yeah, please.
Who just
friend
of the pod, who just said, "That boy ain't right."
It's true.
My review was just, "That kid has some problems."
Definitely.
I shouldn't laugh at my own joke. That's terrible. No. I'm going to edit my laughter out.
Keep mine in.
Keep yours in. So I wanted to read a review from Mike D'Angelo, who we've talked about before.
Yeah.
Mike D'Angelo is a fairly prominent film critic who reviewed this film originally at Cannes and has re-reviewed it for Letterboxd. Mike D'Angelo's top four films are Only Angels Have Wings, which I haven't seen, which is the Howard Hawks film about
airplane
fighters. Have I seen it? Maybe I have seen it. Don't know. Manhattan, Woody Allen's Manhattan.
Hmm.
We've talked about...
A very contrarian topic.
Yeah, we've talked about
D'Angelo. I also think that's not a very good film.
No, I don't think I think that's such a good film.
Aside from him sleeping with a 17-year-old.
And that film being a confessional.
Yeah.
That's what that film is about.
It's also just not very funny.
No, it's not very funny. It's not very interesting.
Yeah.
Double Indemnity. Have you ever seen
that? I love that film. I've seen that multiple times. That is a perfect noir.
It's so good.
Yeah, there's so much good stuff in that movie.
Fred McMurray is so good in the lead role.
And what's his name? Edward G. Robinson.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah, yeah, that's a great film. And then, I've talked about it before, and I've said that maybe you would like this film. I don't think you've seen it. Exotica. Egoyan's Exotica.
Okay.
It would be really interesting to see what you thought of that film.
Okay.
It's a very cool and very removed and distanced film about a series of characters whose lives interact in this way that you gradually learn has to do with a past trauma. So it's kind of Lynn Ramsey, actually. I gave it... How many stars did I give it? I gave it 4 stars. I don't remember writing this review at all, but I say, everyone is a cog in a machine, but by the end you learn the machine doesn't actually do anything. It has no purpose at all. And when you realize that, you're forced to go back over the whole thing and see the cogs for what they are.
Hmm. Pretty good.
I guess that's what the film does. I can't really remember. That's Mike D'Angelo's 4th favorite film. And this is his review. "Even if we posit that the entire film is an untrustworthy memory play warped by Eva's guilt, Kevin is just too overtly demonic to prevent the film from feeling schematically repetitive, especially when Ramsey abandons her initial flurry of hallucinatory fragmentation and settles into a strictly linear groove. It's a dazzling dirge, and this time I clung even more desperately to its one mysterious, destabilizing interlude, Kevin's sudden tender affection for Eva when he gets sick. But the faint echo in the film's opening scene, as he awaits transfer to prison proper, just wasn't enough, and I was set adrift once again."
Yeah. See, I'm not sure, but I don't think the ending is so much of a problem.
No? No, I think the ending is beautiful.
Yeah, I think the ending is one of the better things about the film.
Hmm. We didn't really talk about the soundtrack of this film.
Oh,
which
crazy.
Is almost entirely country classics.
Yeah, the beautiful Is it Buddy Holly, Every Day?
Yeah. That's such a good song. Oh, yeah, that sequences up. Yeah. When
that's perfect. That's yeah. It. That's the whole, her driving through the streets on Halloween.
Yeah.
Post-shooting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's such a Lynn Ramsey trope yeah. to do that with music.
Like the end of Morven Keller.
Yeah, but it works so fucking well. Okay, do you want to... Should we do low-rated, high-rated, low-rated, high-rated?
Yeah. Right.
Every day. My mother is calling me. It is today Mother's Day.
Yeah.
Just dismiss my mother's phone call on Mother's Day. Sorry, Mum, I got to talk about...
we need to mother, talk. Mother... degrading mother-child relationships.
Yes, exactly.
We need to talk about Kevin is a great name for a book and film.
It's incredible. It's really good.
Like the kind of title that everyone knows because it has perfect rhythm and implication.
Okay, I'm going to read this review. I'm not going to give this person's name.
Okay.
Their top four films are Ari Aster's Midsommar.
Excellent.
You know what we should do as a filmmaker for four of you?
Ari Aster. We
never mentioned that.
That's crazy. Two.
Two. Real fun.
Yeah.
Hereditary and Midsommar, two masterpieces. Two of the best films of the last 20 years. It would be really fun.
Yeah. Both films I've seen in the cinema.
Yeah, one with me.
Yeah.
You laughed so much at Midsommar in a near-empty cinema. It was beautiful. That's right.
I'd forgotten about that. It is very funny.
It's
yeah.
Extremely funny. Xavier Dolan's Mummy, which I gave one star. I fucking hate that film.
Okay, never seen it.
Barry Jenkins's Moonlight.
Great film.
A great film. Waves. I haven't seen it, but that's the one that everyone kind of hated.
Yeah, everyone was disappointed in, right? Yeah. People thought it would be good and it wasn't.
Yeah, because the director, Trey Edward Schultz, made It Comes at Night, which I really liked that film. Have you seen that one?
No.
It's really good.
Okay.
Very unsettling, early Roman Polanski-esque horror thriller about a house in the middle of a post-apocalyptic environment in which awful things are happening.
Okay.
It's good. It's really good. It's very tense. But yeah, everyone was really disappointed by that one. So here's this review. This film is so awful, but I feel bad for saying it because Lynn Ramsey seems really nice, so I will...
Does she?
Lynn Ramsey seems cool, lovely. But
like, I think nice might not be the right word. Like, she seems like a great person.
Yeah, you mean through her film, she doesn't necessarily seem nice. So I will blame it on Lionel Shriver.
I don't know if someone who's nice walks off a film on its first day. I say that as a compliment.
Oh,
you know, okay. Like niceness feels very
pat.
Like, oh, I don't want to insult that person. They seem nice. She seems pretty tough.
She knows what she wants.
Yeah, exactly.
I will blame it on Lionel Shriver, who is slightly insane. So, what an opening sentence. Lionel Shriver, this is such an awful story. I hate it. Why the fuck does he decide to shoot people with a bow and arrow? Where did you get that idea? Couldn't he just get a gun like everyone else? Anyway, I know you wrote it to decide if you would have kids or not, but you could have just, like, not published it. Nobody needed it. And also, next time you're on the British Question Time, why don't you not defend Boris Johnson's racist comments?
Oh.
And maybe don't tell the Muslim woman in the audience that she actually hasn't experienced racism, because you would know, wouldn't you?
This seems not exactly relevant
to
the film at hand.
No, that's a half a star review of the film.
Funny. I think
the
film person is projecting.
We need to talk about Kevin.
I mean, I don't endorse any of those things, but that's a different problem.
Very deeply disturbing, would not recommend, half a star. I kind of like people who do that.
The honest, like, the literalism of it. Yeah. Like, hey, I just had this film about a school shooting and a demon child is unsettling.
Yeah,
I
had a bad time. Almost set my TV on fire watching this lump of dog shit. Fuck Kevin, fuck his dumb dick numbskull parents that never even talk about him. Yes!
I mean, that's...
And fuck this movie.
That's more persuasive.
What's that person's top four?
Top four, yeah, films? Please. That's what I was going to ask.
They don't have a top four. Shame. Their last four rated are Hidalgo, the Viggo Mortensen horse movie.
That's right. His post Lord of the Rings opus.
The World's Fastest Indian, the Anthony Hopkins movie about the old guy who drove a motorcycle very fast.
Or a motorcycle.
Savages, the Oliver Stone.
Philip... Oh, no.
No, there's another Savages. Okay. Don't get the two confused. One Savages is Philip Seymour Hoffman and, like, a beautiful drama about aging.
Yes. Is it aging? Yeah, it is. I think it's, like, two kids dealing with their aging parent or something. Yeah.
And the other is an Oliver Stone cocaine heist thriller.
Okay.
This person's review is of the latter film. And Bad Trip, the new Eric Andre Netflix film, which I really want to see.
Yeah, I'm too concerned about Eric Andre upsetting real people.
Really? Oh, you would find it tense?
I think so.
Yeah.
It seemed, I've watched the trailer, it seems confronting.
Yeah. I think I would like it.
Maybe.
That's that person's last four films. Shall we do a five and then a one and then a five?
Sip of tea.
Have a sip of tea. This person's top four films. Ghost World? Have you seen Terry Zwigoff's Ghost World? You would really like that
based
film.
On the comic?
Yeah. The Chloe's, Daniel Chloe's comic. I think you would really like that film.
No, I always thought it was Klaus.
It's possibly Klaus.
Okay, I don't know. I don't think I've ever heard it spoken.
No, I don't know either. I just always said Chloe's.
Maybe it is Chloe's. Right in.
Right in. If you are an overlap between liking A, Brad Pitt, B, Lynn Ramsey, and C, Daniel Kaluuya. I mean, I like all those people, so there's at least one of us. You would really like that film. It's like sweet and beautiful and funny and intelligent and dark in the right kinds of ways. Haozu, the Japanese film from 1977. Unbelievably strange. Basically like a live-action episode of Scooby-Doo, filled with, like, violence and incredibly bizarre set pieces. It's just one of those films that tries to do something different every single shot.
Cool.
It's completely hyperbolic and good.
Okay.
4 stars.
Haozu.
Haozu. Dazed and Confused, the Richard Linklater
film. I've never seen that.
You would also like that.
Yeah, I bet I would.
I think you would like that quite a lot. It's literary in an interesting way.
Okay.
I think you would appreciate it. And Dario Argento's 5-star masterpiece, Suspiria,
which is a great film.
Oh, truly
great. And in retrospect, I think there was a time where I would have said the
remake is better,
but I don't think it is.
It's not better at all. Not even close. Not Matilda, even vaguely. Did you see that? I don't know why this came to my head. I have absolutely no idea, actually.
Okay.
Do you see Sofia Coppola is directing the adaptation of My Year of Rest and Relaxation?
I did not. That makes so much sense. I'm surprised. It feels as if I already did know it.
Yeah. It was initially going to be... Oh, this is probably why I thought it. It was initially going to be Luca Guadagnino.
Oh, okay.
And then Coppola took over. Coppola both, may be a better fit.
Yeah, that's... Both interesting. Guadagnino would make it more ornamental, which I think does not make sense.
Yeah.
For...
It would need...
Well, the Coppola's kind of ornamental.
It would need to be padded out, don't you think? Like, how are you going to make that into a feature-length movie?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I guess there's the sequence at the funeral, which is, like, focus on the stuff with the friend stuff, but then mostly she's asleep.
Yeah.
And there is, but she is like the therapist as well. Maybe it's mostly like framed with the therapist.
Yeah.
Like structured around therapy appointments.
Maybe it's just mostly the awaking moments.
I mean, how do you write a book about it is another question. Like, it's, I don't remember. It's not a short book. I read the whole thing. I read the whole thing. What am I like? Eight.
It's in here somewhere.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about Moshveg.
Yeah. I love Moshveg. It's. I think this is an incredible book.
Okay.
How many pages is it, Dan? Check.
It is... Yeah, it's almost 300 pages. And like standard, you know, contemporary literary fiction pages.
I think people think that it kind of lags and a lot of people don't like the ending.
That's right. Classic end. Classic.
Classic, how else are you going to end? Yeah. No. Are you reminiscing?
Yeah, I'm just trying to work out when she goes to sleep in the book. It's quite late.
It's very late.
Yeah.
It's very late.
I mean, it has to be, right?
Yeah, because there's not going to be a lot of first-person narration while she's asleep. This person's 5-star review is just, I'm so glad I'm never having kids.
Sure.
1-star review?
Do you think this is an antinatalist film?
I do.
Okay. I'm not sure it is, actually.
I think it thinks that having children is bad.
Does Lynn Ramsey have kids?
Yes. But didn't when she made this film.
That's very interesting. Normally not something you want to do is ask whether a female director has children.
No, but in this context, it seems quite relevant. She wrote this film with her then husband, who she broke up with around the same time that she walked away from Jane Got a Gun.
Interesting.
Rory Kinnear is his name, but he's not the same as Rory Kinnear, the actor.
Okay.
Just so you know.
Negative? Are we up to negative?
Yeah, we'll do another negative and then another positive. Lynn, what is the point of your movies? Insufferably bad, just absolute dog shit. Vapid after-school special garbage.
It's so not that. That's kind of a point of view I'm interested in, because it seems so wrong-headed.
This review is kind of beautiful. Bailed after 15 minutes. This was weird and confusing. Couldn't tell what I was watching. Kept jumping back and forth in time. Crazy imagery and mumbling. I didn't want to waste any more time.
Love it. Love that you got a letterbox straight after that. See, it's funny because I also think of that person in some ways as the ideal viewer. Like, I want a person who doesn't know what's going on to watch this because that seems more interesting and experienced to me.
Yeah, but no.
Not to that guy.
No, 15 minutes and that was it. Okay, here we go. This is an interesting one. Top four films. La La Land.
Well, rough. I've watched half of that.
The Shining. I mean, a great film. I like film. The
Shining. It's very good.
But I'm despairing over this as a top four. Rear Window.
A great film.
Lord of the Rings, Return of the King.
Like, that's all weird. Is Fellowship's the best Lord of the Rings? Surely.
Yeah, surely.
That's just a mistake. That's a very funny top four.
This half a star review. This movie is pure misery in 2 hours. What was obviously made to make a statement actually does more damage than good. Just a bitter filmmaker who wanted to make people endure pure filth for the sake of a single message.
Filth is such an interesting word to use.
Filth is a fascinating word. Without thinking about the audience or the film's overall value. Even if the director's intentions were good, it's hard to take away the important message sent without feeling bogged down in a disastrous mood for the entire runtime. I need to cleanse my brain now. Filth, yeah. Filth is really interesting. It feels very,
Puritan.
Yeah, very moralizing. A very different idea of what cinema should be.
Absolutely. Certainly to you.
And the one that I hold. I spend my whole life submerged in filth. Yeah, maybe that's the horseshoe theory. Like, people who love degradation and people who love moralizing both really believe in the existence of filth.
Funny.
What's the most disgusting film you've ever seen?
I can tell you, because it literally made me think I was ill. I saw it at the cinema. I can't remember what it's called. It's French. It's about four men who... It's funny, because I think Dad had told me to see it. Or, like, Dad had seen it and said he liked it or something, and then it was on at the Queensland Art Gallery. Four men who eat themselves to death.
Oh, yeah.
Le Grand
Buffet.
Buffet, yeah.
You had a tough time with that one.
Oh, boy.
I think it's Italian. I think it's for Italian men.
I thought it was French. I mean, I feel like it's French. Hmm. Maybe it's an Italian. There's an Italian version. I'm pretty sure the version I saw was French. I could be wrong though. Actually, I mean, it makes sense in both cultures.
Did you?
It's like these middle-aged men who are like, "We're done with life. Let's just indulge ourselves in a feast." Oh,
you hated it
utterly. I don't even like you said. You said what was the most.
Disgusting.
I don't know if I hated it. I just found it extraordinarily difficult to watch. Mm-hmm. It was disgusting. I have a hard time with like extreme vulgarity, and oh boy.
You shouldn't watch John Waters then.
Well,
I mean, you should.
No, because we did watch that John Waters film together, and I really enjoyed it. Vulgarity is actually not the word I was searching for.
John Waters
film? The Grotesque, I think.
Oh, Serial Mom.
Serial Mom, great film.
Incredible film. What's the most disgusting film I've ever
seen? Yeah, good question.
Oh... Yeah, there's this filmmaker who made a whole bunch of shot-on-video films that are just disgusting. One is called The Cancer Eaters, I think, and it's, like, fucking so gross. It's an attempt to just be, like, as disgusting as possible. There's this whole... It's this whole byproduct of this Japanese film series called The Guinea Pig Films or something like that, which are basically, like, 72-minute films in which... torture is shown in an extremely realistic manner. There's meant to be no overriding moral or aesthetic values whatsoever. It's just basically, how can we make the most realistic looking effects as possible and just show them?
When were they made?
The guinea pig films were made in Japan in the 80s, and all of these offshoots were shot on video in the 2000s.
Okay.
And a lot of people I know who like exploitation cinema love them, but it's just too much for me. It's not what I go to those movies for. I personally relate to the ants. crawling all over Kevin's peanut butter sandwich. Don't really know what that means.
No.
Why would they teach him archery? Damn, that shit was crazy.
That's a pretty good one.
The Omen in real life.
Yeah, I've heard people make that comparison, but it's a bit too obvious.
Perfect movie, new favorite. Ezra Miller is very hot. That is a strange takeaway. They really should have talked to him. Yes, true. This is my favorite movie. I don't plan on watching it again. This review, what a crazy boy, feeling bad for his mother who had to put up with his shit.
I like that. I like the earnestness of something. I can't tell if they're play earnestness, but I appreciate that.
Tomato? The concept of being gaslit by your own child is so unsettling. True.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find something substantial here. There's so many people who just say never having kids. They should probably talk about Kevin. I think there are a lot of people who stand Ezra Miller and who watched everything that Ezra Miller was in. Because
of Wallflower or whatever.
Yeah, but there's just like a lot of reviews by people with La La Land as their favorite film talking about how much they love Ezra Miller in this film.
Is he in La La Land?
No.
But just that kind of...
It's an age thing, I think. Okay, here we go. Incredible.
Great.
This person's top four. Trainspotting. The first Trainspotting. It's an okay film.
Yeah, it's compelling and it's like pretty good. Memorable.
Yeah, I was about to say it doesn't really have much to say. God damn, I contain multitudes. I was just saying how much I don't want a film to say something.
But I know what you mean. Like, it's not.
It's just, it's a bit flashy. It's fun. It's whatever. It doesn't like stick in my craw very much.
Yeah.
Foxcatcher. The one where Steve Carell plays...
Big wrestling coach.
In the words of Griffin Newman of Blank Check, Fat Nosferatu.
It's very good. Oh, this is an insane thing to bring up on our podcast, but have you listened to the Don John episode of Blank Check?
I have, with Hollywood Handbook.
I love those boys so much.
Go and listen to the Don John episode of Blank Check. It's an easy entry point.
Yeah.
You don't need to know anything about the series. And
yeah. Also, the two guests are from my favorite podcast, Hollywood Handbook.
One of Dan's favorite things, full stop.
Yeah, it really is.
Old Boy, directed by Park Chan-wook.
Yes.
You like it?
I think so. One of those films I saw when I was like early on in my so many films stage.
Yeah.
Going to Blockbuster.
When you use the like movies.
Something like that. I certainly experienced them. I still like movies.
No, you don't.
I do. I was just talking about how much I liked something. I can't remember.
When was the last movie that you really liked?
Really liked.
Yes.
I recently watched My Neighbor Totoro for the first time. That was great.
Oh no, this person's fourth favorite film is Grave of the Fireflies. Oh, I thought different. I could bring it back.
Funny.
Very different. My Neighbor Totoro.
Yeah. It's a great film. Masterpiece, actually, I think. And also Kiki's Delivery
Service. Kiki's is better. Kiki's is so good.
Sure. I like the humility of My Neighbor Totoro. No conflict. Sure.
No,
that's what I want. At one point, the little girl loses her corn. That's pretty upsetting.
The mother is extremely sick and possibly dying. You're
never really sure.
sure.
I watched... I don't know. What was the film about the Polish priest...
Oh, yeah, Corpus Christi.
Corpus Christi, great film.
Corpus Christi's great.
I like cinema. I go to the movies. I laughed at Midsommar, remember?
Yeah, I remember. Corpus Christi is really good. It's currently streaming on the Criterion Channel. If you have the Criterion Channel, check it out. Watch Corpus Christi.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's about a young person who pretends to be a priest, right?
Yeah, basically. Am I thinking about the same thing? Right. Yeah. Not young, he's in prison.
Like a criminal.
He gets released sort of from prison to work at like a factory, but instead pretends to be a priest. It's not a cheery film, but it is quite a beautiful film.
Well, that's the thing. The premise makes it sound like it could be like a Mrs. Doubtfire-esque comedy. But it's not. It's bleak.
Grim. Yeah, very a bleak film, but a wonderful film.
Yeah, highly recommend Corpus Christi. This person's review... It's just, this happened to my buddy Travis once.
Great. Oh boy.
Which part?
The whole thing.
next time.
Yeah.
I always do that. Why do I always do that? We were never weekly. No. Were we ever weekly?
I don't think so. In like the next week that matters, which is the week when the Brad Pittcast is released.
Which is, who knows, sometime.
Yeah.
we will be talking about You Were Never Really Here, and we will be finishing our Lynn Ramsey miniseries.
Yeah.
It
exciting.
Will be sad to say goodbye to
Lynn. I'm so... It was Joseph's suggestion for a fewer, and I have found it very nourishing. I look forward to the next one.
What's the next Brad Pitt we're going to do when we return?
Something weird.
Let me have a look. Yeah. Is it Megamind?
I think it's one before Megamind, but maybe it's Megamind.
What was the last Brad we did?
Not Ocean's 13.
Oh, it's Inglourious Basterds.
Oh, great. Okay, excellent. It's not a weird film at all. We're really in the...
We're in the thick of it.
The thick of
Pitt. It'll be strange to return to Brad Pitt.
It will be, actually. It's been a while.
It feels like it's been ages.
Yeah.
They'll be, like, coming home to see, like, an estranged father. Definitely. Or something.
Yeah.
Just kind of a little bit awkward, don't really know what to say.
It's been a refreshing break, though.
It has. It's been great. And the ice will thaw extremely quickly. And we'll have a great time with Brad.
Really, like, if people have listened to this miniseries without watching the films of Lynn Ramsey, watch all the films of Lynn Ramsey.
You'll have an incredible
time.
Yeah. An incredible time. You'll have a nourishing time. You'll have a creatively nourishing time.
Just really, I think, especially if... This is kind of a silly thing to say, but if in any way you, like, are... creative. Ramsey is such an interesting example of someone who you can quickly engage with basically her entire body of work, and you can see someone who has a very clear vision and executes on that vision. I think that's pretty rare and quite, to use kind of a corny word, it's genuinely inspiring.
It really is.
I think she's an inspirational filmmaker, someone who is clearly committed to what she does and is different and interesting, and even if I don't always like what she does, I respect it.
Perfectly said.
Yeah, but we've still got another week on her, so yeah. I'm looking forward to that.
We'll talk about Dan's favourite Lynn Ramsey films.
Good. We'll see. We'll find out. Probably.
You Were Never Really Here next time. Send us an email.
Yes, thebradpittcast@gmail.com.
Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe.
Yes. Follow us on Twitter @BradPittcast. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's it. That's all we got for you.
And we will see you next time.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.